Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. Live concerts can be the stuff of legends, an amazing experience, a way to connect with a favorite artist and fellow fans. But these days, the experience is often marred by high ticket prices, extra fees, cost for parking, food and drinks that leave concert goers drained and annoyed and wondering, is this really worth it? So, what makes for a great concert, and how do live concerts come together? Why do tickets prices cost so much, and how does this industry really work? We'll take a look with independent promoter Sean Agnew. He's the founder of R5 Productions and now one of the owners of Union Transfer, a new venue, or relatively new venue here in Philadelphia. We're also joined by Josh Barron of Relics Magazine. He has written a book called Ticketmasters, The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. And later on, we'll be joined by Jeff Gordon. He is regional president of Live Nation for the Mid-Atlantic. So, Jeff and Sean, thank you so much for being on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Jeff, are you
there? Thank you.
All right, there you are.
Actually, this is Josh.
Josh. All right. Sorry, Josh. How are you?
You're
in New York.
That's
okay. I know you're Josh. You're in New York, right?
So, yes.
Sean, let me start with you. When we go to a concert, as a regular concert goer, we see the band, we see the venue, we might know there's a promoter like you. Who are the other entities that go into making this happen?
Typically, the bands will have a manager and a booking agent. The booking agent is the person who's in control of, or not necessarily in control, but helps lead the band to play the right venues. They also advise on the ticket price. They work hand-in-hand with the band's manager, who then, you know, also helps the band make those decisions.
And who do you contact when you want to book a band?
So typically, I've been doing this for a while. You know, say 15 years ago, it was easier where you could just write the band and interact directly with them. And be like, hey, band, would you like to play this evening or wherever? Now, again, with managers, agents, press people, I generally contact a booking agent.
A booking agent.
Yeah.
And then, Josh, where do the ticket sellers come into this equation?
Right, so the other half of the equation is the promoter, which would be Sean in this instance, and Sean would typically contract with a ticketing agent, whether that's someone like Ticketmaster, Ticketfly, or any number of companies out there that can, you know, create tickets for patrons.
And why do you need a ticketing agent? Is it about knowing how many people will come? Do you need that money of the selling the tickets up front? Why do you need that? Sean, do you want to start?
Well, I guess for us as a venue or as a promoter, it's
you're a smaller. I mean, Union Transfer is mid-level,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, it's a mid-sized venue, and it's essentially one less thing that we have to do. They handle the processing, the refunds, basically all of the process of purchasing a ticket. Which we have several hundred to thousand orders a day. For a smaller company, it's a lot to deal with. Whereas Ticketfly, who is our ticket provider, they can handle all of that, and essentially they deal with all of that, leaving us to worry about the actual shows and concerts and fans.
But it's also, I guess, good to know that you have sold 100 tickets or something,
yeah,
for a show.
Definitely. Yeah, exactly. And it's much easier that, just we basically go into a website and it gives us the breakdown. It takes 3 seconds of who the customers are, what shows have sold what, and how many tickets we sold today, et cetera.
And do you also get a promotional benefit out of teaming up with a ticketing company?
Certain ones, for instance, Ticketmaster has their own email list that they send out to millions of people across. Ticketfly has another strategy where they sort of create technology and software for you to easily promote and interact directly with fans on Facebook or Twitter, other sorts of social media.
Now, Josh, those are kind of the benefits and the good parts of teaming up with a ticketing agency. Of course, your entire book kind of delves into the dark side of that business. So what are some of the cons, or what happens to the ticket prices?
Well, it's not, I think our book explores the development, mm-hmm, of electronic ticketing specifically, because back in the day, in the 60s and 70s, before the advent of, popularized computer ticketing, it was very hard, as you were talking about, to get a show count. How many tickets have I sold? And so you're dropping off tickets at all these regional record stores, and you don't know when they're coming in to sell tickets, and some places are selling better than others. So it was a very convoluted way to sell tickets, and putting them online, so to speak, and computerizing ticketing made it much more efficient. I wouldn't say there's ultimate, listen, it's expensive to do ticketing. Ticketing is not as easy as it appears to do. I'm sure Sean can attest to that fact, and I'm sure Jeff will attest to that fact later. It's a complicated process. To the general consumer, it may seem easy, particularly in this digital age that we live in where everything is online and, oh, it's great, it's easy. It's actually pretty complicated, and when it goes wrong, you need to have the bandwidth to be able to correct the problem. But that ultimately comes at a cost.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's where these ticketing companies, you know, will charge fees. You know, I think everyone agrees that it's fair for a ticketing company or a ticketing agent to make a profit, to, you know, charge for their services. I think where there's a disagreement or, you know, there's a lot of, you know, dispute is how much should those services cost?
And
how much should those be?
How are those costs calculated? I went online yesterday. I looked at a bunch of shows that I have no intention of attending, but just priced out the tickets, and it was all over the place how much the ticket would cost me and what the surcharges were.
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot of different variables, and, you know, a lot of people say, well, why should one ticket cost more than another if it's at the same venue? Well, the situation is that venue is contracted with a ticketing agent on a case-by-case basis. It's not a uniform contract for all venues. So for a major amphitheater and arena, if a ticket's $25, it's set, okay, the ticket fee is going to be this amount. If a ticket's $50, it's going to be this amount. If a ticket's $125, it's going to be this amount. If it's a Icecapades event, it's going to be this amount. If it's a basketball event, it's going to be this amount. So there's all these different factors that are laid out ahead of time in a contract decided mutually between the ticketing agent and the venue. So that's how that's determined.
And Sean, you personally don't use Ticketmaster.
Correct.
Why not? What led you to that decision?
Early on, I was just basically, you know, they were generally the more expensive and seen as, you know, basically, you know, the man or the worst corporating ticket agency out there. As I, you know, started doing this for a while, I started to learn that they actually took a lot of the heat as promoters and clubs were actually putting in what's called rebates into the ticket fee. So, for instance, if your ticket fee was $6, the venue, Ticketmaster is only taking $4, and the venue was actually getting a $2 kickback. And the people were starting to use Ticketmaster as the mule to kind of, or for people to kick around, but it was actually making them money.
Oh, so Ticketmaster was the fall guy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So after, you know, early on, I guess when I was more naive, Ticketmaster is the man, this is terrible. We have to, you know, so expensive. But then start talking to club owners around the country, and you start learning that, you know, Ticketmaster is pretty bad. But on top of that, the club owners are also getting their fees through it that way.
We're talking about the concert industry, about live shows. Right now, we're on the topic of ticket prices and some of the surcharges. Later on, we want to talk more about kind of what makes a great show and why people continue to go to shows. We're talking right now with Sean Agnew. He's the founder of R5 Productions. And joining us from New York is Josh Barron of Relics Magazine, who's written about the ticketing industry in his book, Ticketmasters, The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. So, Sean, you just mentioned some of the other fees. Everybody wants to make a little bit of money, obviously, or wants to make a living. Talk about, okay, so the promoter, how do promoters make their money?
So, as a promoter and not as a club owner, we make our living off the what's called promoter profit. And it's a weird, complicated, goofy math formula. I'm not sure whoever invented it, but it's 15% of what you spend. And then you take 15% of what you spend, and if there's extra money, you get to keep that 15%. It's a really weird, difficult thing to kind of explain real quickly. But basically, if a show is successful, you make money. If a show is not successful, you pay out of pocket,
yes,
and money comes out of your
pocket.
A lot
of bands have guarantees.
Correct.
So you, as the promoter, have paid the band, what, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000? If that doesn't come in,
then you pay out. Yeah, in sort of way, it's almost like a speculative stock market where you're betting that this show, particular show or band, will do well, and you know the guarantee increases in, as your confidence does in the show. But again, if for, you know, whatever reason the band suddenly becomes unpopular, or they say something stupid, or lose fans, or the show
or the
just doesn't do
bad.
Well, exactly, it snows. Then you take a big loss.
And Josh, there's more pressure now, I guess, for bands to make money via shows than ever before, correct? Because sales of music I don't want to call them record sales, but whatever you want to call that these days, are down.
Absolutely, 100%. And, you know, that's part of the, I guess, part of the problem, if you want to call it the problem, or the issue that's facing the industry, is that, yeah, you know, album sales are down, and artists are looking to make that money up in the live market. And, you know, they, you know, I think they take a sometimes short-sighted view of wanting to try to get as much money as possible out of consumers versus taking a longer view and trying to build a fan base that's going to be around for a while and creating a career that's going to, you know, keep coming back to certain markets to generate that kind of income. But, you know, I think it's, you know, I think Sean would agree in that, you know, the promoter business is a small margin business. It used to have much better margins in the 60s and 70s, but as artists, you know, it was a real cat and mouse game between promoters and artists about where the money was going, and ultimately the artists, you know, demanded more and more money from promoters. You know, for a major artist now, they can take anywhere from, you know, 90 to sometimes 100% of the gross profits of a major, you know, stadium show or an arena show, leaving the promoter, you know, to find ways to make money, as Sean pointed out, either through ticketing fees or through concessions, through parking, you know, those sort of methods.
And Josh, we also have a situation now where some of these entities that were mentioned so far are merging together. So Ticketmaster is now obviously with Live Nation. So you have the ticketer and the event promoter in one entity. Sean, you are now a venue owner, part owner. So you are the promoter and the owner. So in some ways, it's kind of combining forces so that the profit doesn't get split on so many levels. But does that cause problems for the industry then, Josh?
Yes, you know, I think there. I mean, it's a complicated question. I mean, you know, I think it would be a bit unfair to analogize what Sean's
no,
doing.
No, of course.
to, you know, the consolidation we saw in the late 90s with the SFX roll up in this company that then became Clear Channel, which then became Live Nation.
Right.
You know, unquestionably that helped drive ticket prices up. That wasn't the only factor in doing that, but it certainly catalyzed an acceleration of prices to go up. You know, and obviously there are issues with consolidation in terms of if a band, for instance, doesn't want to use Ticketmaster for whatever reason, you know, it can be difficult to place, you know, certain venues in certain cities without utilizing Ticketmaster. Or, you know, Live Nation obviously controls a number of the major amphitheaters in this country. If for whatever reason you don't want to book an entire tour with Live Nation or a majority of your tour with Live Nation and you want to play outdoor amphitheaters, it can be a challenge to find venues.
And we saw that happening with Pearl Jam, certainly. That's Josh Barron of Relics Magazine. We're also joined by Sean Agnew. He's the founder of R5 Productions. And we're talking about the live concert industry, how it is changing. And coming up, we want to talk more about great concerts. So give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499, and you're listening to Radio Times.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing Education at PAFA offers art classes and workshops for all ages and levels this fall, including figure drawing, portrait painting, bronze casting, silk screen printing, and more. Featuring pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, landscape on location at historic Yellow Springs Chester Springs Studio, and a masterclass with noted artist Bo Bartlett. Classes begin September 13th. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
What can you do when your homegrown tomatoes are failures in flavor? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a look at the potential causes of tasteless tomatoes and reveal some last-minute tricks you can try to induce a flavor boost, plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Comedian Michael Ian Black has a new memoir. Up till now, his comedy might have been described as, I don't know, smarmy, but the book's different.
I have a knack for saying awful things, and part of the reason that I wrote this book was to start dismantling that persona.
Michael Ian Black on Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about live concerts and the industry behind that makes all of that possible. And joining us here in the studio is Sean Agnew. He's the founder of R5 Productions and one of the owners of Union Transfer in Philadelphia. Also joining us is Josh Barron of Relics Magazine. He's written Ticketmaster, The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. And Josh, I do want to get to the actual joy of being at a concert and what makes it great. But you talk also in the book a bit about scalping and how that has changed with the many opportunities that people have online now. So what is kind of the state of scalping tickets for popular shows and how do people do that these days?
Well, what's interesting is that with the advent of the internet, it has allowed people that would otherwise feel uncomfortable doing so to enter into the secondary market in a way that they were unable to a decade ago. So I think there's a lot of, you know, to the bigger point of where do concert tickets go and why are they so hard to get and why do we keep hearing about all these quick sellouts, you know, it's very common now for someone to buy 4 tickets to a concert when they only need 2, and their thought is, I'm going to resell these 2 tickets on the secondary market and pay for the other 2 tickets. Or you have people that don't even necessarily live in the same state buying tickets to resell them because they know they can hopefully turn a profit. And these are not serious ticket brokers. These may be people living in the Midwest that want to make a little bit of extra money in a down economy. They know they can do this. You know, if they do a little research and they speculate, they can do this.
So everybody's in on the ticket business.
Yeah, because it's become a faceless transaction. You're not the guy in a trench coat outside an arena saying, hey, you got my tickets. You know, you're a mom of 2 living in Kansas that, you know, wants to make a little bit of extra money. And so I think there's a lot of that out there that people might not realize. Obviously, there's still major ticket brokers, you know, but I think there's also a lot of different hands dipping into the pot of tickets.
Now, one more question about this business of tickets. Sean, you mentioned before that sometimes, you know, it causes a problem when a venue is a Ticketmaster venue, for example, has an exclusive deal. There are artists who want to try to get around this whole deal and want to keep their tickets affordable. So what are people doing? What are bands doing to get around this?
A lot of bands have what they call fan club ticketing Basically, what it is that a certain percentage of tickets are made available directly through the band. Typically, it's 10% or less because most ticketing deals with venues state that they have to sell at least 90% of the tickets. But at least that's one small way where they can try to get those surcharges down and offer a cheaper direct ticket to the band without having to pay, you know, the hefty surcharge.
And describe a bit, or maybe you can, Josh, what Louis C.K. had done with his tickets where he sold them directly to his fans. Is that feasible, I guess, only for somebody who has the kind of following that he does?
Well, I think what made it super feasible in Louis C.K.'s case is that he's one guy. You know, he's a guy with a microphone. That allows him to be extremely nimble in terms of the actual requirements that he has to put on, the physical requirements that he has to put on for a show. So he can play any number of auditoriums, small theaters, non-traditional venues. You know, a band certainly of a particular size has a lot of physical requirements of what their lighting needs, electricity needs, all of these types of things. You know, so that makes it a little bit harder. That being said, you know, there are bands that are looking to, you know, do things outside the traditional realm. You know, for instance, 2 nights ago, I saw Mumford & Sons here in New York. They played Hoboken. It was the opener of their U.S. tour. They played on a pier in New Jersey that had never been used as a concert venue. They sold tickets through Frontgate Tickets. They sold their fan club tickets through Artist Arena. And they made no fanfare about, oh, we're not going to go with Live Nation. We're not going to go with Ticketmaster. They simply quietly did this and had a lot of success. There was almost 15,000 people there. All of the venues they're playing on this first leg of their tour are non-traditional, non-Ticketmaster venues. So there's certainly a way to do it. It just takes a little bit more effort upon the manager, the band, etc., to do it. You know, they have to be willing to do it.
And Sean, you certainly in Philadelphia have a status of the guy who beat the man, so to say, on many occasions. How did you get into this? This is a very difficult business. It's very risky. What drew you to it?
So I started pretty atypically in terms of what traditionally is the concert business. I started going to punk shows in warehouses and basements and art galleries, basically anything but a club, and just became real attracted to it, like the intimacy of being real close up to the band, being able to talk to the band, having the band sell merch to you directly, sort of the typical DIY punk rock scenes, all the benefits of that. And just, I never went into this thinking like, oh, I'm going to become a concert owner or a venue owner or a business owner. Just started basically contacting bands I liked and just saying, hey, would you like to play Philadelphia? And learned from my friends who were also setting up shows. And, you know, just basically started maybe doing, I think the first year I tried to do 4 shows, and the next year 8 shows, and the next year 16 shows. And these were all little tiny baby shows and really small, you know, punk rock type venues. And just over the years, it slowly grew. And I think maybe like 3 or 4 years, I dealt with my first booking agent and signed my first contract with a band, and just had a real slow growth that eventually led to what it is now, where we're doing like 400 shows a year.
And how did you establish your relationship? You became somebody who was able to bring acts to Philadelphia, even though you were just you as a guy, yeah, and didn't have kind of a big name behind you.
Fortunately or unfortunately, I'd say, in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, because of our liquor laws, a lot of the clubs were 21 and up. And at the time when I started booking shows, I was 18. And basically I was writing to the bands, asking them, like, hey, I can't see you in this club. Would you want to play this dirty, smelly garage instead? I can promise, you know, more people will come. And, it actually worked. And after a while, I guess, you know, a sort of reputation was established where bands would talk to other bands and be like, hey, instead of playing this, you know, dive bar, why don't you play this awful, smelly garage in West Philly? But, you know, there'll be more kids, you'll sell more tickets, you'll do more merch. And through that way, it started working, where then we were able to get, you know, more traditional, less punk bands to start experimenting with that model.
Let's get Matt to join us from Westchester. He's calling in. I think he's been to one of your shows, Sean. Hi, Matt. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. Sean, I just want you to know that you're one of my heroes. I'm a 48-year-old guy who loves live music. In fact, my wife and I make a New Year's resolution every year that we're going to see live music at least once a month. Every year. And a couple years ago, back in about 2007, I was on a blog, a music blog is how I get a lot of my interest in music, and I found out about this one band, and I really, really liked them, and I get the R5 newsletter, R5 Productions newsletter email, and I saw that they were coming to the church basement in Philadelphia, and I got very excited. It was only $10. So I was very excited. I told everybody, this is a great band. You have to come. You have to see them. And, of course, everybody was like, yeah, 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 Matt, whatever. And the Thursday night before that band played on Friday, they were on the Letterman show. And on Friday, I got to see this band. It was Vampire Weekend.
Oh.
And it was about 500 people in this church basement. And I was as close to Ezra as, you know, as you could be. And just that kind of feeling of being, in at the ground floor of something that was about to explode was fantastic. The band only had one album, and they played all of their songs. And, of course, the next week, more so because of Letterman than R5, they on iTunes, they became the number one album.
Yeah, and Matt,
so
let
I
me...
I was the coolest guy in the room.
Thank you so much, Matt, for that call. And, Sean, I do want to ask you about that. I mean, sometimes, obviously, you get lucky. You know about this band, you've been following them, and then they end up on David Letterman the week before your show. But how do you know? How do you have that feeling like, ooh, this band is it, or they will be it?
It's I would say it's definitely almost all luck. For instance, when we just talked about Mumford & Sons, I did their first show in Philadelphia where they played a small, tiny chapel opening up for another woman. There was maybe 50 people there. No one had any idea who they were. But, you know, when they finished their set, everyone was like gasping and amazing. Or same thing could be said for Arcade Fire. We did their first 4 or 5 shows.
Remember that?
Yeah, at the first all sorts of different weird spaces. And after every show, people were just, you know, floored and amazed. So you can kind of tell by crowd reaction initially. You're like, wow, this band's something special. You can kind of get the trajectory. But of course, and everything, things that are always popular aren't necessarily, you know, the best. But in terms of building slowly, you can generally tell by the crowd reaction. When it's good, it's good.
And Josh, is that part of the thrill for many music fans, to kind of be there to know the band before everybody else has the T-shirt, so to speak?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think one of the first times I saw the Felice brothers was at, you know, I'm sure it was an R5 show, and I was in, I think, the church basement, or I don't know if the church basement is the same as the Unitarian church,
yeah.
But, you know, it was raining outside, and, you know, everyone's sitting in these pews, and it was absolutely amazing. And that's what we, you know, my co-author and I, Dean Budnick, try to remind people. If you're upset, you know, versus paying $100 to see a concert, and that's sort of your budget to see live music, why not go see five concerts for $20 or more concerts for $10? Because, you know, the thing is that I had a great experience at that venue of Sean's, and so did the caller now, just Matt. So even if they don't know the band, they know it's going to be a special experience, and they're going to go to it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of ways, you know, to see bands in smaller venues. It's just a much more thrilling experience than sitting in the back of an arena. Not to say that seeing Prince in a huge arena, if you're in the 400s, isn't great. I did it, and it was awesome. But there's something to be said for seeing a band in a small venue, and we've really tried to encourage people to get into those small venues and take a chance on a band that may be coming up.
And speaking of big artists, we do want to welcome Jeff Gordon to the program. He is joining us. He's regional president of Live Nation for the Mid-Atlantic. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hi, I'm not a big artist, though.
But you put them on stage, don't you?
We put all size artists on stage, actually, big and small. We're lucky enough to own and operate the TLA, and involve a couple of small venues around the city. So I think anything from, you know, 50 people to 50,000, we cover a lot of ground.
Jeff, in your mind, what's oops. All right. Is that your cell phone?
Yes. I keep busy, as it turns out.
Yeah, it turns out. Now, Jeff, what is the thrill of, in your mind, what is the thrill of going to see a big artist, somebody you've been following and loving all your life?
I think it can be the thrill of seeing them succeed in their artistry and profession, and see them achieve a certain level, and along with that ride, you take it with them. So that's exciting. It seems like, you know, almost like being validated that you were right that Coldplay would go from a small venue to, you know, multiple arenas, or U2, or, I mean, even tonight with Wiz Khalifa and Mac Miller, which is, you know, something that's very exciting. We're doing 20,000 plus people, so it's, you know, it's different tastes, different genres, and it's definitely a success story when they achieve that success, and you kind of feel like you're part of it, because you sometimes in on early, or some friend turns you on, or whatever the case is.
And I want to hear a clip. Let's hear. We have a clip from Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and they are doing the version of Tom Waits' song Jersey Girl. So let's hear that.
I got no time for the corner boys down in the street making all that noise, for the girls out on the avenue, 'cause tonight I wanna be with you. Tonight I'm gonna take that ride across the river to the Jersey side. Take my baby to the carnival.
And that's, I guess, the kind of moment, Sean, you were just laughing when you heard the crowd, you know. I guess that's the moment, though, that we all want when we go to a big show, right?
Yeah, definitely, where you're, you know, with tens of thousands of people, and you know, you're sharing something special and unique. And obviously when it's that size, it tends to be stand out and be a lot more important.
And Jeff, what are, in your mind, the kind of components, the ingredients that make for that experience? What has to be there?
For the atmosphere of the concert, or for the artist to achieve that level of success?
No, just for the atmosphere, for the concert goer to really feel like, wow, that was amazing, and I could have never gotten that watching that artist on YouTube or on television.
Well, I think concerts in general are a tribal experience. I mean, the good news is that at some point there was a fear that maybe TV or HDTV or something like that, or some kind of projection, would take away from the live experience. But the fact is, when you go there, you smell it, you feel it, you touch it, and you hear it. And you can't take that away. It's just, there's nothing better than that, as far as I'm concerned. I've felt that way for the last 25 years of my life or more since I've been going to concerts, and lucky enough to be in the music business and doing this. So I think that you just can't take that away. The live experience on a concert does not translate at all on a flat screen or even a 3D screen. You got to be there.
Unless
you want to see
pop.
All the people that like the music that you like.
And Jeff, do you go to concerts all the time? You know, you live and breathe concerts, so do you still go a lot?
Do I still go a lot?
To concerts, as a concert goer?
I'm at a show five nights a week.
Right, but do you go as a, you know, when
sure,
you go there,
would,
do you
yeah.
go as a, how do you experience it?
Pardon me?
How do you experience it? Because it's your show, in a way, you have your hand, but do you still experience it as a fan? Can you still say, wow, this was amazing?
Sure. I watched the entire Roger Waters show a couple of weeks ago, and it was possibly the best show I've ever seen in my entire life. And I go out and see pretty much most every show. I watched System of a Down last night. I watch every show that I go to. I watch a portion or a good portion of the show. I'm not protected in a cocoon area or anything like that. I like to go out and see how the crowd's reaction and what's going on in the vibe. So, yeah.
And Josh, what was your favorite live show, big, big live show that you've seen as of late?
Big, big live show. You know, I was able to see Springsteen for the first time in the New York, New Jersey area when he came through Madison Square Garden a little while ago. So that was pretty impressive, I have to say. I mean, you know, he's one of the few out there that can command an audience that way and make it feel that intimate. You know, U2 has a way of doing that, and I suppose a few others. But, you know, he's just... And the length that he plays. I mean, you know, Relics covers jam bands, and they do two sets. Bruce does one set and plays as long and doesn't stop. So it's a pretty impressive feat of musicality and just musicianship.
Sean, how about you? What was one of your favorites recently?
this almost goes against everything what we're just talking about. It was more of a funny, like, wait, what's happening here? When I went to this past Coachella for the first one, and watched Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg perform their classic hits and albums. And when the weirdest thing ever came, when it was a hologram of Tupac, and it basically was like 50 or 60,000 people just confused, scared, freaking out. Some people actually thought it was a real person. The person I was next to thought it was 50 Cent. It was a big, funny, I don't know, like just weird, big concert experience.
But that speaks to the kind of showmanship
exactly,
that
yeah.
also goes into.
Yeah, exactly. And where is 50,000 people all reacting and there's...
Right.
Yeah,
there's How much really is memorable. That important to you? You're a guy who goes to smaller shows where all that, the lights and all of that is not that important. But do you enjoy that when you go to a big show?
Yeah, definitely. It's pretty rare that I go to a big show and I'm going to be the contrarian, like, oh, everything's so much better in the tiny little dark basement. I personally enjoy, you know, being more of an active participant, being up close front to the band, talking to the bands, or just being in a small room with them. And I think also for business sense for me too, those bands, for instance, the example of Vampire Weekend, where I'm still friends with them and they still remember that tiny show. But it is sort of a fun novelty to go to the bigger shows.
To the bigger shows. And we'll talk more in a moment. We're talking about the concert industry and what makes for a great show, why people go to concerts, and what puts this all together. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to excerpts of our interviews with Gore Vidal from 1988 and 1992. He died Tuesday at the age of 86. Also, an interview with Lee Maynard. His new novel, The Scummers, is the third in his trilogy about growing up in West Virginia. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Coming up, we begin our series called Brixion. That's fiction from countries on the rise. We start with Brazil and author Clara Averbuch, who takes the girl meets boy can't let him go story to a whole new place.
There is something that annoys me a lot in the female characters. They don't have flaws. Even when they have flaws, they have no contradictions.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Republican Karl Rove reinvented the business of political finance by revamping the Democrats' playbook. Now he might swing the election for the GOP. Also, we preview Monday's scheduled landing of the rover Curiosity on Mars. Will it make it to the surface safely? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the concert industry, live concerts, what makes them happen, why we enjoy them, what makes for a great experience. Joining me here in the studio is Sean Agnew. He is the founder of R5 Productions and one of the owners of Union Transfer Venue here in Philadelphia. Josh Barron is in New York. He's with Relics Magazine and has written Ticketmasters, The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Sculpted. And we're also joined by Jeff Gordon, regional president of Live Nation for the Mid-Atlantic. And Jeff, what are some of the big shows that are coming up in Philadelphia this summer and beyond?
We're really excited about a festival we're doing on Labor Day weekend with the headlining. One night is Jay-Z, other night is Pearl Jam's Budweiser Made in America Festival with a lot of great acts on it. It's pretty exciting to bring a festival like that to Philadelphia. And also exciting that the entry point on that ticket price was 2 days for $99, so we're glad we can bring a lot of acts to the city for a good value. Also excited, like I said, tonight, sure enough, tonight, Wiz Khalifa and Mac Miller, two acts, artists that have played the Roots Picnic, which is an event we do at Penn's Landing every year, now doing 20,000+ people. Those are the ones, I mean, on top of mind. I mean, we have a lot of other things that are coming up, but those are the ones that are top of mind right now for me.
And talk a bit about what goes into putting this together. We always hear about artist riders, what they request, what they want to have. You know, those are the stories we hear as concertgoers and fans. But what are some of the major headaches in putting together a huge show like that? What do you have to think about and be aware of?
Well, starts with an idea, obviously, and then, you know, logistics. You know, whenever you do any kind of public assembly, there's no matter if it's for 50 people or 50,000 people, you have to make sure that you have a safe environment that's going to, you know, have enough accoutrements and ancillary stuff for people to either get food, drink, or bathrooms and stuff like that. You know, make sure that that's all organized. And then, of course, it becomes the process of putting the shows actually on sale. Excuse me, coordinating the talent, but putting the shows on sale, and then producing the event.
And Sean, what are the biggest nail biters for you as a promoter? What's the toughest part of doing this?
A lot of times where if you're unsure of an artist or an act and how well they'll do, I think it's generally probably across the board with any job, but when you're unsure and it's a risk and you're basically, again, speculating whether or not the show will do well or it won't do well.
And what are some of the biggest flops or maybe the biggest flop you put together?
There was recently a band called Kaiser Chiefs.
Yes.
Who we thought would do way better, and it did quite terrible.
Really?
Yeah.
What did they do? What did you expect and what came out?
I mean, it wasn't catastrophic. Again, this is at a mid to smaller level, but we expected probably around 500 or 600 people, and I think it ended up doing like 150 or something.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interject, but usually the rule of thumb is this. If you take a table and you put thousands of dollars on the table, light it on fire.
Yep.
If you go to put it out, you can't be a promoter.
Yeah.
So he said. So you just look at it burn?
And if you can watch it burn, then you can move on to the next.
Oof, but that's hard to take. So what happens to you, especially when you were smaller, when you didn't have your venue? Let's say you've already paid that band $5,000 or whatever it was. What would you do, Sean?
Generally, and when I was smaller, now I have a venue that has, you know, there's alcohol sales, food sales, etc. So the venue doesn't come out of my pocket.
It catches you to some extent.
But yeah, I still do my own independent shows outside of Union Transfer. And for those, you know, again, you just have to pay the price. Independently, when I'm doing a show outside of Union Transfer, I'm a lot less likely to take a risk, where mm-hmm. I'll be more, I guess, responsible with my money, where I don't want to set it on fire. I'd like to keep it for as long as possible. So I'll be a little bit less risky in booking shows. And when I'm booking shows independently, I tend to also be selfish and book the bands I like rather than bands that everyone else likes. Because, again, it's not at a particular venue where I have to keep in business or keep a calendar. I can just book the shows I want. And generally, the shows, if I'm familiar with an artist, then I'll know how well it will do and So in general, there's almost no risk when I do the shows I want to do.
And we want to invite people to talk about their favorite shows and any questions they have about up-and-coming artists. 1-888-477-9499 is that number, 1-888-477-9499. Josh, I'm sure you've seen your share of bad shows, so what were some of the ones that stand out in your mind that you really didn't enjoy or were a huge flop?
None are immediately coming to mind, I have to say, but you know, one festival, I was going to ask Jeff if he could comment on this too, but you know, festivals are very popular right now, and while they're great for fans and they're good for promoters when they're successful, there's also typically a lot more risk involved with them. And we had, you know, people have been trying to do festivals here in New York City for a long time, and there was a festival last weekend called Catalpa that did terribly.
What is that? You know, what did Catalpa?
Yeah, it was a festival. The Black Keys were here. Snoop Dogg was here. Again, I always like to say when a festival doesn't do well with poor attendance, it's oftentimes a great fan experience because fans can get very close to the action. But for the promoters, you know, they can lose their shirt. So it can just be very tough. And, you know, you always want to try to get bodies in there. But, it's I think we've all seen certain festivals, you know, do really well and other festivals not do well that are, you know, for reasons that are well beyond their control. I mean, you know, I think Jeff's festival in Philadelphia is going to do really well. That being said, I think he also has some stiff competition. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but there's also Bruce Springsteen's in town that same weekend.
Yeah, you know, and there's also Rock the Bells that are playing, I think, New Jersey that weekend, and New York has Electric Daisy Carnival, I think, that weekend as well. So there's a lot of competition on that weekend. And the Eagles are playing down Atlantic City. It's a busy weekend. But, I think you have to take the approach of seeing. I mean, I was lucky enough, I should say this, I'm blessed and lucky enough to have a curator in Sean Carter, Jay-Z, that really is very intimately involved in this. So that is a leg up, to say the least, because he's such a talented and smart individual. So that has helped, and it has had a lot of artists want to come and play because his involvement. So I think I've got an advantage there. I also think that we try to design it to be convenient and not super challenging of a place to try and get to, and sometimes that has something to do with it, especially in the Northeast. So far, so good. You know, like I said, 4 weeks out, and hopefully we'll have great success with it.
All right, let's take a call. We have Greg joining us from Center City. Hi, Greg, you're on Radio Times.
Hi. First, I wanted to give a little anecdote about one of my favorite shows we went to in the fall of 91 when I was in college. We went to visit my friend at Duquesne in Pittsburgh and to see the Chili Peppers, and this was really before they kind of blew up majorly, and they had two opening bands that we had not heard of at the time, some band called Smashing Pumpkins and a band called Pearl Jam, for $15 in a gym in Duquesne, so that was a very nice surprise retroactively. I do have a question for Jeff. I went to go get tickets for a show at the TLA, and really one of my favorite artists, Bob Mould, but it also had Dinosaur Jr. there, and I was really put off the fact that it was $25 face value, but on top of that was $15 for fees, which, you know, it's a 40% markup, and I won't actually, you know, just out of, I don't know, my personal feelings, don't intend to go to the TLA again anytime in the near future, just merely based on that. I didn't end up getting tickets. And luckily, both of them are playing at Union Transfer in the near future. But I guess I'm really wanting a bit of more of an explanation as to that seems like such an egregious markup on the charges of tickets. I'd like to hear a little bit about that from
Greg,
the perspective of Live Nation.
We did talk about tickets a bit earlier, but Jeff, is this something you can weigh in on? Is that something that you even deal with in your role at Live Nation?
Well, I don't set the service charges. I do know at the TLA that we do. Most shows, I think all shows, if I remember correctly, is that at the box office you can come down and alleviate the convenience charge. I'm not sure which option you chose for print at home. I'd have to crawl into it more. I understand that percentage of the ticket price to be levied against that sounds
probably pricey. I don't know. That sounds like an incident that I could definitely check into. But having said that, for the club shows and the TLA shows, we always usually have an opportunity to either have a small service charge or no service charge. Okay. As an option.
Thank you, Greg, for that call. Now, having said that, Josh, what do you say? What do you pay for a show ticket? What are you willing to fork over, depending on who you're going to see, of course?
Well, here's the thing: is that two points that we always like to make is one that you know, if people are upset, you know, he said he was upset with the $25 fee plus the $15 fee. If he's upset about the $25 base price, that anger mainly needs to be directed at the artist, because that's the biggest determining factor of the ticket price. Yes, you know, Ticketmaster levies fees on top of that, but the biggest bulk of the price is coming from what the artist is asking for. Secondly, and it sounds like he did this, you know, if you're upset about a price, don't pay it, because every time you buy a ticket, you're telling that artist, you're telling the promoter, you're telling the manager that it was a fair price. If you vote with your feet in your wallets, the next time they come around, there's a very good chance that the ticket prices are going to be a bit lower. But every time you buy a ticket, you're saying that price was a fair price. Even if you buy kicking and screaming, you're indicating to all the parties involved that you felt it was a fair price.
And Sean, where is attendance at your level of concerts? You've done this for a long time. Are people as enthusiastic as they were 15 years ago?
Yeah, I'd say right now, again, in that smaller to mid-level range, unlike the rest of America, there's an emerging middle class of bands, where there's lots of bands who necessarily aren't going to become like millionaires, but there's bands who actually can make an affordable, comfortable living touring. Whereas when I started, you know, in the mid-90s, a lot of the bands at that level were, you know, had to still work full-time jobs or were, you know, struggling, sleeping on people's floors. Now there's those same size bands in, you know, 2012 are actually able to pay their rent at home, to stay at a hotel.
Not and sleeping on your couch.
Exactly, which I'm glad that no longer happens. And then, you know, still have a couple, you know, to make, you know, $60,000 to $120,000 a year touring in a mid-level band. And I think that's ultimately, again, more healthy, and it's probably not the best thing for, you know, for larger concert promoters, where there's obviously less bands to fill that role, and that's where I feel like festivals and stuff like that come in, where you can group a bunch of these bands together and then have them play.
And Jeff, are people going to big shows, especially during a recession, or is that something that gets cut first?
Thankfully, I can say that we're having a very good year. I think that there's more of a people are looking to maybe put together much better packages and a much more compelling value for the dollar, which I'm a big fan of, mm-hmm. of course. And it's not just band X, and you never know who's going to open up. There's a lot of good packages that have won out in the last 12 to 18 months. One of the more successful ones, you know, Watch the Throne with Jay-Z and Kanye was unbelievably successful. It was a high ticket, but everybody felt absolutely was valued at that. And like tonight is not as high of a ticket, and the kids are coming out to see Wiz Khalifa and Mac Miller. So I think there's a definitely, everybody's gravitating towards a good package when you want to go to a bigger place. It doesn't necessarily have to have the big act, but at least a decent package where people feel compelled, like it's a nice show, and put some value to it.
And I think another great value, just another example, this summer for stadium plays has been Kenny Chesney and Tim McGraw and Grace Potter. You know, I think the average ticket price is about $60 for a stadium show, and it's done very well. I mean, he does this every summer now, and, you know, I think it's a helpful model and a helpful example.
The country artists have definitely led the way for years as far as packaging and value for the dollar. I mean, we had Jason Aldean with Luke Bryan the other night, which was an amazing show. And that was a great value for the dollar, too. And I think, median ticket prices are lower than most.
And, Sean, where is Philadelphia as a concert city? We were once great and amazing, and every major act came here, had to make it in Philly. Where are we now?
I think we're still probably number 4 or 5. Jeff might know better than me in terms of the size of the market. But it's definitely still on people's lists of places to play, for sure.
And in the minds of fans, Josh, you're in New York, so how do you look to Philadelphia?
I mean, I...
New York bias aside, of course.
No, I think Philadelphia is fascinating in that you have a lot of local competition that are, you know, forcing each other to do better, book better shows, book more interesting shows. You have Sean, you have Jeff, you have AEG. You know, they're all, you know, trying to figure out their own place, their own niche, and, you know, serve different fans. And I think ultimately for consumers, that's a good thing because, you know, they're all trying to make their mark. And I think, you know, that's, it's great. You know, and I think, you know, there's a wide variety of shows for such a, you know, something of a small town compared to New York or L.A.
All right, and with that, we're going to have to close. The last voice we just heard is Josh Barron of Relics Magazine. He has written Ticketmasters, The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. Josh, thank you so much for being with us. Also in the studio joining us was Sean Agnew. He is the founder of R5 Productions and one of the owners of Union Transfer. And also on the phone joining us was Jeff Gordon, regional president of Live Nation for the Mid-Atlantic. Thank you so much for being here. And what we're hearing in the background is Bob Marley and the Wailers, Concrete Jungle, and this is from a live concert at the Quiet Night Club in Chicago, Illinois, in 1975, and that was Josh Barron's pick for a favorite performance. Thank you all so much for joining us here on Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, and our engineer has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for listening.